Good evening and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm Shweta Mishra, your host, joining you from India. And this evening on Cure Talks 102nd episode and our fifth talk on fertility and reproduction, we are discussing recurrent miscarriages, causes and treatments. Miscarriage, medically defined as spontaneous abortion of the fetus before 20 weeks of gestation, is cited as the most frequent problems in human pregnancy. The American Society of Reproductive Medicine has recently defined recurrent pregnancy loss as two or more pregnancy loss. According to the National Survey Analyzing Perception of Miscarriage, couples pay a huge price due to the lack of knowledge of the reasons that led to the miscarriage. So knowing the cause is important. But unfortunately, doctors are struggling to find a cause for almost 25% of this. Today, we are talking to our eminent guest, we will also delve into questions related to available tests and treatment options, as well as new developments in patients and treatment. On our earlier show, we talked to Dr. About the risk factors. We discussed what is the situation in young adult cancer survivors with Dr. Sureka Jao, and with psychotherapist. Our expert today, Dr. A. Bendix, is an author of gynecology at the U.S. as well as nurse as research director. Dr. Bendixson joined U.S. residency at Harvard School and completed her subspecialty training in research in endocrinology and in fertility at Cornell University. She specializes in recurrent pregnancy loss, endometriosis, polycystic ovarian syndrome, failed implantation, and XPs. She is opening USC Center for Pregnancy Loss this spring and aims to provide the highest quality care for the patient. I welcome you to Cure Talks, Dr. Bendixson.
Thank you, Shweta.
Shweta? It's our pleasure to have you, Doctor. Yes.
It's very nice for me to be here. Can you hear me okay?
We all can hear you okay, Doctor.
Wonderful. Well, I am so happy to be here today to shed light on this important and often neglected issue of miscarriage, specifically recurrent miscarriage. I think it's important when we talk about miscarriage that we, I know you defined it a little bit in the intro, but just really to think about the term miscarriage. And when people use that term, they are usually referring to a loss of the pregnancy that occurs in the first trimester, which is the first 3 months of pregnancy. Miscarriages are very common. They occur in 15 to 20% of all pregnancies. So they're much more common than people think or are aware of. I believe that many people are unaware of how often miscarriages occur because oftentimes it's something that a woman keeps private and doesn't share with even her closest friends. Having more than one miscarriage in a row is less common, and that's what we refer to recurrent pregnancy loss. Fewer than 5% of women will suffer two consecutive miscarriages, and only 1% of women will suffer from three consecutive miscarriages. In my practice at USC Fertility, I see a lot of both fertile and infertile women who have suffered from a miscarriage or multiple miscarriages. In my consultations with these women, I find that they really focus on three things that they want me to answer for them. One, why did this happen to me? Two, can we treat it? And three, what is the chance that this is going to happen again? I think it's important, and what I always tell my patients is that the more miscarriages a woman has in a row, it the more likely it is that she is going to miscarry in a subsequent pregnancy. So if you think about the background risk of having one miscarriage is about 15 to 20%. After a woman has suffered two losses in a row, the chance of a loss in the next pregnancy increases to about 30%. And after three losses in a row, the chance of another miscarriage actually increases to about 35%. The chance of miscarrying just gets higher and higher the more losses that a woman has. However, for that very same patient, instead of actually thinking about the fact that they have a 35% chance of miscarrying, if instead you focus on the likelihood that they will actually have a baby with their next pregnancy, the chances are high. So even when they've had three miscarriages in a row, the chance of having a baby with that next pregnancy is 65%, which is really good. The majority of miscarriages are caused by non-inherited genetic abnormalities. People refer to these types of abnormalities as chromosomal abnormalities, and they account for two-thirds of miscarriages. Genetic material in all of our cells is packed into these tiny structures called chromosomes. When the egg and the sperm come together during fertilization, an embryo is made. This is just a term for a fertilized egg. Both the egg and the sperm are supposed to contribute one set of chromosomes to the embryo. If there's an error in the egg or sperm development, it may lead to the amount of genetic material in the embryo being abnormal. It means there's either too many or too little chromosomes in that embryo, and we call that a chromosomal abnormality. Chromosomal abnormalities are most often caused by random errors in the development of a woman's eggs, not in the sperm. And this eventually leads to an abnormal amount of chromosomes in the embryo. It's these types of chromosomal abnormalities that are random and not inherited that are the cause of most miscarriages. Now, this is true for a woman who has one random miscarriage, and it's also true for a woman who has had multiple miscarriages. The majority of chromosomal abnormalities happen as a function of egg quality. So these chromosomal abnormalities can happen in women of all ages, but it's going to happen more often as a woman gets older. In fact, age is the most important risk factor for miscarriage in a healthy woman. So unlike sperm that are constantly created in men, all of the eggs in a woman that she will ever have are present in her body from before the time she was born. Therefore, as a woman ages, her eggs age, just like any other cell in her body. As the eggs age, they are more likely to have a mechanical failure as they develop, which leads to the egg contributing too much or too little genetic material to the embryo, meaning that there's either duplicates or an incomplete set of chromosomes. Therefore, that embryo will end up having an abnormal amount of genetic material, which we call that chromosomal abnormality. The chance of miscarriage in any woman is greatly impacted by her age. The older a woman gets, the more likely it is for her to miscarry. The risk of a single miscarriage is only 15% in a 35-year-old. However, by the age of 40, it increases to 30%, and by the age of 40, the miscarriage rate is over 60%. There is some evidence to suggest that male age may also slightly increase the chance of miscarriage. If this is true, the cause is unknown, as we do know that embryos are not more likely to be chromosomally abnormal when the male partner is older. Another very common cause of sporadic miscarriage is a congenital anomaly in the baby, also known as a birth defect. A congenital anomaly is a condition that occurs when there is an abnormality in how the baby is formed as it's developing. Significant birth defects that are not compatible with life often cause early miscarriages. For example, if there's a severe abnormality in the development of the brain or the heart, this could cause an early miscarriage. Chromosomal abnormalities and even severe congenital anomalies are most likely to cause miscarriages that will happen before the 10th week of gestation. The further along a woman is when she miscarries, the more likely it is that there is another factor that's actually causing the loss. When a woman has only one miscarriage, it's very common to never know why they miscarried. Part of this is because a workup to assess why it happened doesn't usually occur at this time, because the odds of getting pregnant and having a baby with the next pregnancy is really good. However, even with one miscarriage, it is important for a woman to meet with her obstetrician so that they can review together the woman's medical history and lifestyle and make sure that there isn't something obvious that needs to be addressed at that time that could impact the next pregnancy and the health of the next pregnancy. Even with a first loss, it is possible to test the tissue that passes with the miscarriage and send it to a lab to assess for chromosomal abnormalities. For most women, that information may not be useful because the likelihood is that they will have a baby with their next pregnancy. However, I would argue that you never know which patient's going to have multiple miscarriages, so having that information could be extremely valuable in the future, so you might as well send off that information to begin with. When a woman has recurrent losses, we can identify a cause of their losses in about 50% of couples. Unfortunately, many of these causes are treatable. Structural issues within the uterus can lead to miscarriage. This is a very common cause of recurrent miscarriage. Women can be born with an abnormally shaped uterus, or throughout their life, they can develop non-cancerous lesions called polyps or fibroids. Women can also develop scar tissue within their uterus as a result of an infection or from a previous surgical procedure. All of these uterine issues are associated with a higher chance of miscarriage. The good news is that in many of these situations, the uterus can be repaired surgically. If, however, the uterine issue cannot be fixed, the couple does have the option of using gestational surrogacy to get pregnant. Gestational surrogacy is when the embryo of a couple is actually transferred into another woman who has a healthy uterus so that she can carry the pregnancy for them. In order to use a gestational surrogate, the couple needs to go through in vitro fertilization, or IVF, to get embryos from their eggs and sperm that can be put into the healthy uterus of the surrogate. So even though the surrogate carries the pregnancy, the baby is 100% genetically related to the intended parents. So gestational surrogacy can solve an unfixable uterine issue. There are also several immunologic diseases that have been postulated as increasing the chance of miscarriage. However, the only disease that has been proven to cause miscarriages and pregnancy loss is antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. This is a disorder in which the immune system attacks the proteins in the blood that leads to an increase in blood clotting, which can result in that woman having either a blood clot in her leg, or it can also result in having multiple first trimester miscarriages. Luckily, this disease can be treated very effectively to decrease the risk of miscarriage by putting the mom on baby aspirin and a blood thinner. So this is also another example of an easily treatable issue. Endocrine imbalances have also been associated with miscarriage. Poorly controlled thyroid disease has been associated with pregnancy loss and infertility, which can be corrected with medical management of the thyroid problem. Likewise, uncontrolled diabetes can lead to increases in miscarriages as well as certain birth defects. A very common endocrine disease is called PCOS, which stands for polycystic ovarian syndrome. PCOS also increases the chance of a miscarriage. PCOS affects 5 to 10% of women, and it's caused by an imbalance of sex hormones, specifically an increase in the amount of testosterone that leads women to have irregular periods, and it also increases the chance of miscarriage. The risk of miscarriage for a woman with PCOS may be 3 times as high as the general population, so that's pretty significant. The reason why women with PCOS are more likely to miscarry is not fully known, but it's thought to be related to how the hormone imbalances affect the uterine environment. Unfortunately, there is not a way to reduce the chance of miscarriage for women with PCOS. Lifestyle factors can also contribute to the risk of miscarriage. These include extremes of body weight, being either underweight or overweight. However, exercise is not associated with miscarriage. Anything that can contribute to an extremely toxic environment inside the uterus will also increase the chance of miscarriage, like excessive amounts of drugs, alcohol, caffeine, and any amount of smoking. A rare but treatable cause of recurrent miscarriage is an inherited genetic abnormality where one of the parents has an abnormality in their genetic makeup that they keep on passing down to the baby each time they get pregnant, which therefore leads to these repetitive losses. These abnormalities can easily be tested for in the parents, and we can treat them by using something called preimplantation genetic diagnosis with in vitro fertilization. So the couple can go through the in vitro fertilization or IVF to have embryos created in the lab, and then we can actually test those embryos for that specific genetic abnormality to determine which embryos are normal and which are abnormal. This way, we can transfer back only the normal embryos into the uterus and avoid transferring back those abnormal embryos and therefore avoid having another miscarriage. Likewise, IVF can actually be used to treat the most common cause of miscarriage, which is chromosomal abnormalities. By screening the embryos to make sure that they have the correct number of chromosomes, in a process called preimplantation genetic screening, we can avoid transferring back chromosomally abnormal embryos and therefore, again, greatly diminish the chance of a miscarriage. In extreme cases, when the egg quality of a woman is very poor, oftentimes a function of her age, an egg donor can be used to help the couple have a baby. With egg donation, a young woman will go through IVF and donate her eggs to a couple that either has infertility issues or recurrent miscarriages. By utilizing eggs from a young woman, the chance of miscarriage is decreased because the egg is younger and healthier and less likely to have a chromosomal abnormality. The eggs from the donor are fertilized with the sperm from the male partner, and then the resulting embryos are transferred back into the uterus of the female partner. Although the baby will not be genetically related to the female partner, the woman will still have the opportunity to carry that pregnancy. And so that is really important to many women. I think it's important to understand that day-to-day stress and anxiety that is part of normal life is not thought to cause miscarriages. It's unclear if extreme levels of stress can increase the chance of miscarriage. Certainly, there is very clear data that suggests that having a miscarriage in and of itself can be emotionally traumatic. And it can take longer to heal from a miscarriage mentally than actually physically. Women experience a multitude of emotions when they have a miscarriage, from anger to numbness and depression. And I think it's really important to take the time to grieve and to heal and to seek support from those around you that can help you through this difficult time. After many years in my practice caring for both infertile and fertile patients who have suffered from a miscarriage or late pregnancy loss, I really noticed a profound lack of centralized resources for these patients, and I felt compelled to take action and create a center where patients could receive care from professionals who specialize in different treatment modalities in a coordinated fashion. And so, therefore, that's the reason that I'm launching the USC Center for Pregnancy Loss later this spring.
Okay.
It's going to be the only center in Southern California that is dedicated to providing world-class care to those patients who have endured pregnancy losses. At our center, we will be having experienced multidisciplinary team, which includes physicians of all specialties, nurses, therapists, acupuncturists, and other mindfulness professionals who will be able to expertly guide patients to achieve a healthy baby. Our experts of all types will be formulating individualized plans to help patients who previously had not had a clear path to treatment to achieve their goal of a baby, while at the same time really helping those patients heal from the grief of their previous loss. Women who have suffered from any type of pregnancy loss have unique needs because of both their history and what they've gone through. And I think that, you know, what we're going to take our approach at the USC Center for Pregnancy Loss to address both past and future in all treatment modalities is really unique, and we'll be taking a holistic approach addressing the patient's needs of both their mind and their body, preparing the patient for a healthy pregnancy. And so with the launch of our center, we're going to be able to provide compassionate and extraordinary care for those patients who have either suffered for recurrent early pregnancy loss, as well as a single loss later in the pregnancy in the second and third trimester. I think that these women need care. I think that there is a lack of care for these women, certainly in any kind of coordinated fashion. So I think in summary, the most important thing is just to really remember that miscarriages are extremely common. And the best news is that there are many treatable causes of miscarriage, and that in most cases, with or without treatment, the likelihood is that with the next pregnancy, the couple will be able to have a baby.
Yeah, that's so good to hear, Dr. Bendixson, and you described it so beautifully. And just one question I wanted to ask you, does low folic acid intake also, can that also lead to miscarriages? We know that it leads to spina bifida in babies, but can that be a reason for miscarriages?
I think it is unlikely.
Okay, all right. All right. All right. At this point, I want to bring in our co-host for today's show, Fran Meadows. Fran is an author and infertility advocate, and she became a mom through IVF to her one son. She works with women fighting infertility by providing hope and inspiration and a friend to lean on. And she has authored the book titled The Truth Behind the Secret Infertility. And we have on our panel today with us Davina Fankhauser, who has a very, very impressive work profile in the field of fertility advocacy. She's a 15-year-long former infertility patient who has now two children with IVF. She has extensively lobbied for infertility health benefits, national funding, and family-building legislation at the state level. She has led strategic efforts to update the Massachusetts definition of infertility and see cryopreservation of eggs become a required benefit of infertility and available to other patients with medical need. Davina founded Fertility Within Reach in 2011, through which she trains people to advocate for infertility. She also helps oncology patients preserve their reproductive health through her non-profit program, Banking on the Future. Davina is a member of many prestigious societies and also a recipient of many prestigious awards like the Congressional Award, Resolve Advocacy Award, and many others. So I welcome you both to the show, Fran and Davina. And before we begin into the panel discussion, I would like to remind my listeners that we will be discussing questions sent in via email at the end of the show. So you can mail your questions to priya@trialx.com. And if you want to ask a question live, please press 1 on your keypad and we will bring you live on air to ask them. Or you can post your questions on QTalk's website as you listen to the show. So with this, Fran, I hand it over to you now to take the discussion forward.
Great. Thank you, Shweta, for having me again today. And welcome to Dr. Ben Dickinson and to Davina. Thanks for having me here to ask some questions. And Dr. Ben Dickinson, for the first thing, I'd like to firstly thank you for taking the initiative to open up about the Center for Pregnancy Loss that you will be launching shortly, because I think it's really a good way to start a discussion and open up those resources for patients that have suffered with pregnancy loss like myself. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome, really. I'm very excited and hopeful that it's going to be useful for many patients.
I'm sure it will be. I'm sure it will be. And with that, for myself, I suffered with a very late pregnancy loss at 25 weeks, and this topic is something very sensitive, near and dear, and it's also something where I want to continue the conversation for so many other women that I've been hearing stories of miscarriage or late pregnancy loss. And with that, my first question for you is, for a woman that goes to her regular pregnancy checkups and their screenings up until a few days before either going into labor or being scheduled for a C-section, why do full-term stillbirths still happen with all the monitoring, and, you know, how could they be prevented?
Sure. Stillbirths that occur like very late in a healthy pregnancy are rare, and when they do occur in a healthy pregnancy, a lot of the time, unfortunately, there's an unexplained cause, and we really don't understand exactly why it happened. Two causes that we do know that can happen in very late pregnancies are an umbilical cord abnormality or a placental abruption, which is when the placenta prematurely separates from the uterus. With both umbilical cord abnormalities or placental abruption, the onset of both of those things is very sudden, which is why there isn't a warning sign. And then because there's not a warning sign, there's no way to predict that it's going to happen, and therefore it's very hard to prevent. On the other hand, there are some causes of stillbirth that can get picked up early. For example, fetal growth restriction, which is commonly a result of placental dysfunction. This is still a very common cause of stillbirth. And if the woman is having routine prenatal care, her doctor should be able to diagnose that the baby is not growing well and is growth restricted, and then take measures to assess the baby's well-being and deliver the baby early if the baby is having issues. And in this scenario, a stillbirth could be prevented. But unfortunately, many of the causes of these very late stillbirths are unpreventable because they can't be predicted.
And now if somebody were to, like myself, have a stillbirth, and then, I mean, I did go on to have a full healthy pregnancy after my stillbirth, would there be other indications of, you know, maybe, you know, I would suffer like a miscarriage, like if I were to get pregnant again, if I did have a stillbirth, or is that kind of rare?
No, so because you've had one stillbirth does not mean that you are more likely to have a miscarriage in the future, and I think a lot of your chance of having another stillbirth would be dependent on why it happened in the first place. If they couldn't figure it out, or if it maybe was because of a placental abruption, you know, I think it's worthwhile to explore, for example, with a placental abruption, you know, make sure that the uterus has a normal shape and doesn't have some kind of congenital anomaly that would predispose you to having a placental abruption. I think many placental abruptions are random, and it just was horrible to happen to you, but probably wouldn't happen again. But for other women who have a structural abnormality in the uterus, they are maybe are more likely to have that happen.
Right. And so going through fertility treatments, I went through to conceive, and then I lost my first child. And, of course, you know, the first thing I was thinking was, it's my fault. What did I do wrong? Sure. You know, but then I thought afterwards, did this happen because of fertility treatments and medications? Mm-hmm. And are there indications that fertility treatments can cause pregnancy loss? Or And on the other hand, do you believe that when somebody is on like progesterone and oil, are they effective in helping prevent miscarriages? Because this is something that I've heard.
Sure. So there's not an increased risk of miscarriage or stillbirth after fertility treatments. However, advanced maternal age is an independent risk factor for both miscarriage and stillbirth. So older women who are more likely to have a miscarriage because of worsened egg quality, leading to the higher rates of chromosomal abnormalities. And older women are actually also more likely to have stillbirth, and that is even after accounting for medical issues that are more likely to occur in older women that are associated with stillbirth. So the fertility treatments per se don't increase your risk for miscarriage or stillbirth. I do think that sometimes very, very early miscarriages are caught more early with fertility treatments because we're monitoring the pregnancies so much more closely and carefully than in a spontaneous environment. For women who have had multiple miscarriages, there is good data to suggest that supplementing with progesterone actually does not improve their outcomes. And this is specifically for miscarriage. I'm not talking about progesterone in terms of preterm labor because that is a different animal. In terms of progesterone for miscarriage, there's actually a pretty recent study of over 800 women that showed very well that the progesterone didn't improve outcomes. However, there are certainly are smaller studies that do indicate that progesterone could be beneficial for women who have had multiple miscarriages. In certain situations where the ovary is not able to produce enough sustained progesterone secretion, then in those situations, progesterone is absolutely beneficial, and this can occur when there are mild medical issues like thyroid disease that are impacting progesterone secretion. Progestins, which is how we deliver progesterones to you, it's the type of medication. So progestins can be administered both through vaginal suppositories or through intramuscular shots, and both of those are equally efficacious, and both of those are actually superior to taking oral progestin therapy. In the end, although progestins don't necessarily improve outcomes in all of the research that's out there, it is a very common treatment for women with recurrent loss. And a lot of that is due to the fact that, you know, progesterone supplementation is unlikely to cause any harm in the pregnancy. There's very few side effects. So many physicians feel that it's worth prescribing, even if there's only a small chance that it could have a positive impact on another pregnancy.
Great. That's really great information, I'm sure, for so many people who are, you know, listening in. So, I mean, thank you for all that great information. And, you know, it's a really great resource for other people to hear, you know, talking about this conversation. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome.
And at this time, I'm going to introduce Davina to come in and go ahead and ask the questions. Davina, are you there?
I'm here, Fran. Thank you so much. And
hi, again, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you, Shweta, for inviting me, and Dr. Bendixson, thank you for your time and your expertise. This subject is very important to me. I was someone who I've experienced 10 pregnancies, and I've been lucky enough to come out with 2 children through IVF. But I'm extremely passionate about it, and I hope to educate as many people as possible so they don't have to go through, you know, necessarily what I went through or Fran went through. I was wondering, you know, when I miscarried, I would feel my body was letting me down or that my body wasn't meant to be pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I would feel hesitant or feel a loss of hope. And I was wondering, does that ever impact the body's ability to become pregnant or to sustain a pregnancy when you tend to feel a bit down like that?
Sure. No, I think the amount of anxiety, hopelessness and actually even emotional detachment that a woman experiences when she's had pregnancy losses in the past do not contribute to her ability to either get pregnant or to her having another miscarriage. And I think that that's really, really important for people to know, because I think anyone who has suffered from one loss or multiple losses, whether it be early or late, all of those feelings, I think, are normal and are very common. So it's important to know that those feelings are okay and they're not going to make things worse for your next pregnancy. I often find that many patients of mine who have miscarried feel extremely anxious and ambivalent and sometimes super disconnected from a current pregnancy until they pass the point in the pregnancy where they miscarried previously. So I think it's really important to acknowledge these feelings, try not to quench them, know that they're there, they're real, and that they are very common.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, you know, one of the things I had always wondered about is because I seem to always get pregnant, I would get pregnant once a year, and then I would miscarry in my first trimester, and way back then the doctor would say, oh, it's just your normal, you know, percentage chance of miscarrying. But, you know, after 3, 4, 5 miscarriages, I'm thinking, really? This is my odds? Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, after how many miscarriages should a patient receive a thorough exam, and what does that evaluation consist of, and is it covered by insurance, all those kind of questions.
Sure. I think even after one miscarriage, it's advisable for a woman to meet with her obstetrician to discuss, you know, what factors surrounded the miscarriage and to review the woman's clinical history so that they can identify medical issues that could have possibly contributed to the loss. Obviously, you want to rule out anything that is out of the normal that could be fixed. You know, I also think it's really important to meet with a doctor so that the woman gains an understanding of why miscarriages occur and understanding that, you know, her chances of conceiving with the next pregnancy are very good, so to give her that hope. After 2 miscarriages, it is recommended to see a specialist who can proceed with a more thorough and complete workup. And the evaluation is going to basically run down all of the known causes of recurrent miscarriage and rule that couple out for every single one of them so that, one, you can understand why the multiple miscarriages have happened, two, identify if there is something that you can fix. And so that evaluation is going to consist of blood work. So in the blood work, you are going to test for ovarian reserve, which is related to the woman's age. You're going to rule out some medical and hormonal issues. You're going to look for those inherited genetic abnormalities that I talked about, and you're also going to rule out antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, which is that one blood-clotting disease that I talked about. You will also be looking at the uterus and to make sure that the uterine cavity is normal, and there's multiple different radiologic tests to do that. And I think that many insurance carriers will cover this, but some won't, and I think that you have to just look in to figure out if yours does or not.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. So I wasn't sure if this was considered an infertility workup or you know, working up causes related to OBGYN issues.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it really, again, depends on the insurance carrier.
Yeah.
And some of these tests can get run by the routine obstetrician gynecologist. I mean, oftentimes you can even go see a fertility specialist, and then they can just make the recommendation, and then your OBGYN, who maybe is within your insurance plan, can actually run those tests for you. And that's what I do with a lot of my patients. I just want them to get the workup done. It doesn't matter if they're doing it at my office or through their own obstetrician.
Gotcha. Well, so after one of my losses, I ended up having a D&E. versus passing everything naturally. And I was wondering, what are some of the risks associated having a DNE versus passing everything naturally?
Okay. So I'll explain a little bit for the audience so they make sure that they know what a DNE is or DNC. When someone's been diagnosed with a pregnancy that's no longer growing inside the uterus, they have several options at that point. The woman could go under a DNC, which is the type of procedure that's performed in the first trimester. And this is a very simple procedure where the remaining pregnancy tissue is removed from the uterus. Another option is that a woman can take some oral medication that will induce the miscarriage to occur. So the woman will pass the pregnancy on her own, but the medication will just make it happen really quickly. And then the last option is that the woman could just wait and see and try and let the miscarriage happen what's going to happen and happen on its own timeline. They're all safe. And the choice that the woman decides upon sometimes will depend on how far along she is in her pregnancy, because the farther along in the pregnancy she is, the more bleeding that's going to occur if the woman is passing it on her own. So sometimes when it gets to a certain point, it's kind of inadvisable to pass the pregnancy on your own just because it will be so uncomfortable and so unpleasant. A lot of times it depends on the personal preferences of the woman herself, whether she just prefers getting it all over with really quickly while she's asleep during a procedure, or if she wants to be able to just pass it on her own, but she doesn't want to wait for it to happen naturally. She wants to kind of do it over a weekend when she's not at work, and she knows she can be at home. So that's when taking the medications can be very effective. And they are all safe options. A lot of it is just really due to personal preference. Pros of having a surgical procedure that has been kind of put forth is that, if you do the DNC procedure, we can get genetic tissue testing done. And I think that it's actually important to know that you can get genetic tissue testing done on the products of conception, whether you have a procedure called the DNC or if you pass the pregnancy at home. Because even if you pass the pregnancy at home, you can collect the tissue and bring it into the office and we can send it off. In both of those cases, we can send that tissue out to a lab that will test it, and they will be able to determine if the loss is because of a chromosomal abnormality or not. And so I think that is really important. And I'm not sure what you went through, but typically when people refer to the procedure of the DNE, that's when it's the procedure that removes the pregnancy in the second trimester of pregnancy, and that's the surgical procedure that women undergo. When women have a loss in the second trimester, they still have the option of a medical induction, or they can go through the DNE. And again, both of those are safe, although actually in the second trimester, the DNE procedure has less risks. And so actually that is chosen more often than the medical induction.
Okay. Well, I do have a – thank you for that clarification, and I do have a follow-up question.
Sure.
Remember this happened to me once where it was like a Friday evening and I miscarried. Mm-hmm. And I kept the tissue and put it in a baggie and put it in the refrigerator. Is that what people should do if the doctor's office is closed for the weekend?
So the best thing is literally to go out to put it in a baggie, you can do that, and put it in the refrigerator. But go out to a pharmacy and get some saline. Which is just the salt water you can get that people use for kind of for flushing their eyes out. And you can actually get like a little plastic cup from a pharmacy and put the tissue in that. I think it's really important to understand what your obstetrician has in terms of their capabilities of sending the tissue out for genetic screening, because there's a lot of amazing technology that's out there now, and there are these new genetic screenings that are being done. And so it's important to make sure that the best and most advanced testing is being done. And many obstetricians, unfortunately, are using these outdated genetic tests that oftentimes will actually fail to diagnose the tissue and or give you ambiguous results. And so especially when tissue, if you've passed it on a Friday night and you're not going to go into your doctor's office by Monday, with these old testing modalities, they're more likely to not get a result. And they're also more likely to not get a result if, for example, the pregnancy loss was diagnosed at 6 weeks and then you didn't pass it till 8 weeks. The new testing that we have at our office and is available at many fertility centers, those problems are not issues anymore. And so it doesn't matter if the pregnancy loss was diagnosed at 6 weeks and you're now passing it at 8 weeks. We can still send the tissue out and we'll get a result every single time, and we're not going to get an ambiguous result where they give you a result where they tell you, well, we're not really sure what this means and we can't tell you for sure if it's normal or not.
Can you clarify, like, the what mm-hmm. is old and what is new? Because how will a patient know if the doctor is using the old?
So the old genetic testing is where they literally culture out the tissue and they just send it for a karyotype where they just kind of look at the chromosomes. The new genetic screening is through and that's something that's typically done through a hospital. The new genetic screening is the type of screening that's done when we're testing embryos with IVF, where they use very advanced modalities, something called competitive genetic hybridization or SNP arrays or next generation sequencing to diagnose, to specifically find the abnormality. They can determine and separate out maternal tissue from baby tissue. So I think that it's the best way to actually maybe determine with your doctor if they have those newer technologies or not, is just to ask them, well, how are you going to be testing the genetic material? And if they say karyotype, then that's not what you want. I mean, you can get that, and if you get a result, then it's okay, but I think it just oftentimes is just you spend a lot of money and you don't get the answer that you want.
That's fantastic. Thank you for that. So I was wondering, so what do you think are the best treatments for someone who experiences recurrent miscarriage?
Well, I think, and, you know, the treatments for recurrent miscarriage are really going to depend on the cause. And so I think that this is where understanding, you know, what the cause is and understanding, is this related to maternal age? And if that's the scenario and it's a chromosomal abnormality issue, then IVF with pre-implantation genetic screening can be very effective. Or if this is a uterine structural issue. So, for example, there's a congenital anomaly of the uterus called a uterine septum. So women are born with these abnormally shaped uteruses. And typically that's not anything that you would ever have picked up in a pelvic exam or an ultrasound. You would never know you have it. And these women suffer from a high rate of miscarriage. And in fact, if you have a uterine septum, the chance of having miscarriage is about 25%. In these women, if you can go in with a very simple surgical procedure called a hysteroscopy, which is where we put a camera through the cervix and go into the uterus, and you just cut and remove that septum, it's so simple, the miscarriage rate is decreased by 90%. And
wow.
So it's amazing. And so I have seen this multiple, many times in patients, and it's just a very effective, simple thing that can really dramatically change the outcome. And I think another one of those kind of very effective treatments is with antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. I think by treating women who have this syndrome, all we have to do is treat them with baby aspirin and a blood thinner, and their chance of miscarriage is decreased by 70%.
Wow.
So for those, you know, for those two scenarios, we have great treatments that can be very meaningful for the pregnancy outcomes in the next pregnancy.
This is so helpful. I wish I had known all of this when I was trying to build my family. I have one more question for you, and it
sure.
may seem really odd, but I heard that eliminating microplasms can help someone who miscarries. Have you heard of this? I'm wondering what.
Yeah, I have absolutely heard of it. So there are certain infections that can lead to miscarriage. So, for example, if a woman contracts a disease like Listeria, toxoplasmosis, which is from cat litter, or herpes, all of those can cause sporadic miscarriages in the first trimester. There are no infections that actually cause recurrent miscarriage. People have hypothesized that certain infections like mycoplasma and ureaplasma cause miscarriage, but there's no good research that supports these.
Thank you so much. And I know Shweta has questions for you, but I just want to thank you again for this information. It's amazing. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you, Davina, for handing me over. And you had some great questions, which will make a very informative talk today. And Dr. Bendixson, you talked about aneuploidy or the chromosomal abnormalities, and you really explained very well what goes wrong there. But is there a way to stop that from happening in later pregnancies, if suppose we know that was the case in the previous one?
I know. Well, you know what? As of right now, we don't have a way to prevent chromosomal errors from occurring in embryos. It's not something we can predict either with our current technologies, for example, like an ultrasound of blood work, and it's because chromosomal errors don't occur until the very final stages of the egg development, which happens at the time of ovulation and fertilization each month. So these stages of development when the errors occur are very late in the process, and they're not something that you can see months ahead. You know, currently there's lots of interesting research taking place trying to figure out how we can think better about chromosomal errors. For example, there's research looking at mitochondrial levels in the embryo and how that affects aneuploidy. Mitochondria are the energy-producing organelles in our cells, but we're really a long way off from figuring out a way to completely prevent aneuploidy. I think solving that issue is akin to preventing aging. You know, but at the current time, the best thing that we can do is test the embryos for chromosomal abnormalities in the setting of IVF with pre-implantation genetic screening. And, you know, by doing this, we can greatly decrease the chance of miscarriage by avoiding transferring back those embryos that have the abnormalities.
Right. So do you compulsorily do the PGD for each and every embryo that is created by IVF?
We don't for our infertile patients. For patients who specifically have recurrent miscarriage, I actually talk to them about what their options are, and not everyone wants to do pre-implantation genetic screening. And remember, even without treatment, even for someone who has suffered four miscarriages, there is a decent chance that she'll have a normal pregnancy in her next pregnancy if she just tries again. But I think that sometimes what it comes down to is that people are just so tired of miscarrying that the thought of going through another miscarriage is just untenable. And so in those situations, PGS can be very useful.
Okay. All right. So my next question relates to IVF. Do you think that the use of frozen eggs is one of the causes of increased miscarriages in people who are trying to conceive through IVF? And is there a study which is such a correlation?
Yeah, no, there's no evidence that using frozen eggs increases the chance of miscarriage.
Okay. All right. Okay, I think I saw some study in JAMA or some publication which shows that lower live birth rates are related to use of frozen eggs. Is that true?
When they say that the clinical pregnancy rates with frozen eggs, you know, it's still, the jury's out, but it's still being that they might be slightly lower than IVF. But that's not because people are miscarrying. It's just that their chance of getting pregnant is actually a little bit lower.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. All right. So my next question also relates to IVF, I wanted to know if there's a correlation between the day in embryonic development on which the embryos are transferred, for example, the day 2, day 3, or day 5 embryos, and a recurrent pregnancy loss. Is there a correlation?
Yeah. So after IVF, the embryo is kept in the laboratory for it to develop, and we can transfer it back into the uterus at any time between day 2 and day 5. When the embryo continues to develop normally at day 5, it should reach a particular stage of development called a blastocyst. Unfortunately, embryos that are chromosomally abnormal become blastocysts all the time. So therefore, transferring embryos back at day 5 instead of day 2 isn't going to avoid transferring back a chromosomally abnormal embryo. Even how the embryo looks on day 5, whether it's a good quality embryo or a poor quality embryo based on the physical features of the embryo, is not predictive of chromosomal abnormalities. So really the only way to decrease pregnancy when choosing which embryos to put back is to test them with the preimplantation genetic screening, and that is actually performed at the blastocyst stage. So you have to let them develop for 5 days in the lab.
All right. Okay. All right. So next question is about DNA fragmentation in sperms. So first of all, I would like you to explain to the audience what DNA fragmentation is and what is the possibility of a sperm with the fragmented DNA fertilizing an egg to form a viable embryo, and has a high DNA fragmentation rate of sperms been shown to be one of the reasons for miscarriages?
Sure. So DNA fragmentation is a measure of the integrity of the DNA within the sperm. That's the genetic material within the sperm. During the time that the sperm travels from the testicle to the ejaculate after it's been formed, it can get damaged. DNA that is more fragmented is more likely to be damaged during sperm transport. The DNA fragmentation test is a way to assess the state of the DNA in the sperm. However, the issue is that existing data does not support a consistent relationship between abnormal DNA fragmentation and poor reproductive outcomes. There are a few studies that have looked at the relationship of DNA fragmentation to pregnancy loss. And a recent meta-analysis did find an association between DNA fragmentation and pregnancy loss after IVF. However, there isn't any evidence to suggest routine testing of DNA integrity because there is no useful way of using that information in order to predict the pregnancy outcomes. So I think that researchers are currently looking at the use of antioxidants and retrieving sperm directly from the testicles as a way to improve DNA integrity. But as of now, there are not reliable ways to and proven ways to fix DNA integrity at all. So therefore, DNA fragmentation testing is not recommended in patients with miscarriages.
Okay. All right. I think my next question is on immune abnormalities, and I have a listener's question on the same topic. I think I'll read out the listener's question. What are the treatment options that are available for immune abnormalities that cause recurrent pregnancy losses, and what are the recent developments in this field that we can be hopeful about?
Okay. So the most common immunologic disorder is the disease that I talked about already, the antiphospholipid antibodies. And antiphospholipid antibodies are proteins in our bodies that have been created to impact our blood clotting system. Phospholipids, and specifically, are substances that are required for the blood to clot. So if the body mistakenly identifies these phospholipids as foreign, it's going to form antibodies against them. And these antibodies can increase the body's tendency towards clotting. We think that antiphospholipid antibodies can cause miscarriage by causing clotting in the blood and the placenta, and that obstruction to blood flow leads to tissue death within the placenta. The only antiphospholipids that are associated with miscarriage are the ones associated with antiphospholipid antibody syndrome. And so I think that that is really important to understand. There are a lot of companies and physicians that market potentially harmful and difficult remedies to fix supposed immunologic issues for patients with recurrent loss. And these companies and physicians are preying on the patient's desires to do anything, pay anything, and take anything in order to have a baby. So treatments like steroids and intravenous immunoglobulins that are prescribed to fix certain immunologic causes of recurrent miscarriage do not work and are potentially dangerous to the patient. So I actually get really upset when I find out patients have really been because I've had this happen many times where patients have been swindled into paying just exorbitant amounts of money for useless tests, for all sorts of immunologic tests that have no bearing, and treatments that could actually cause complications in a future pregnancy.
And you mentioned baby aspirin. So people with antiphospholipid antibodies are supposed to take baby aspirin?
Yes, baby aspirin and a blood thinner.
Okay, all right. Okay, at this point, I guess, Fran, do you have any more questions for Doctor?
Maybe one last question, just kind of going to the emotional aspect of it. I know as doctors, you guys are people too with feelings, and I'm sure that in your, you know, I'm sure in your office you've experienced a miscarriage or a stillbirth with one of your patients. And my curiosity is, how do you separate your professional and personal feelings when something like this happens in your office?
It can be very challenging.
Sure.
I think it's really hard to separate out personal and professional feelings when a patient has a loss. I'm really attached to my patients and personally connected with them, and so these losses are devastating for them, but they're devastating for me. They're devastating for everyone that's involved in their care at our office, and especially if that patient has gotten pregnant after long-standing infertility and fertility treatments. So I think in answer to your question, I don't fully separate my professional and personal feelings, but I think that that's what makes me an empathetic and caring doctor, and I think that you can still be a compassionate and sensitive doctor and kind of open yourself up personally and at the same time provide excellent kind of objective medical care.
Right. I'm sure. I mean, I know, like I said, going through my experience, it was very hard for me to even walk into the doctor's office after the fact.
Yes, that's
and
very common.
It's like you could just feel like, you know, the faces, like you could tell, like, and I think, you know, like even being in the hospital afterwards, I find that doctors in hospitals with their staff, sometimes, I mean, the people I've ran into when I was there, I didn't feel they were well equipped to deal with these tragedies.
And
they didn't have compassion or professionalism. And that was bothersome to me. And that's why, like I said, I really think that your Center for Pregnancy Loss is really going to be a great way to kind of make people heal and, you know, experience their feelings and express how they're feeling, but yet find their way of healing on their own and balance. And that's kind of like what I did on, you know, afterwards. And I think that, you know, there should be a lot more protocols in place, I guess, for hospitals, because sometimes I feel, you know, when I was there, it was just kind of like they just noted, like, on the door, like, don't go in there, don't go in there.
Absolutely. You're so right. I think the majority of hospitals have protocols in place to guide staff members to help them manage kind of the medical and social logistics when a patient has a stillbirth. And every labor and delivery unit I've ever worked on, kind of they have that binder that has, you know, the medical protocols for the doctors and the medical protocols for the nurses and then outlines for the nurses to kind of guide them through all of the logistical steps that needs to be addressed and, you know, the packets for the patients that have resources for them, et cetera. But that being said, I mean, it's hard. It's hard to teach compassion and sensitivity to people. And I think that's something to kind of keep in mind is that stillbirth is not that common. And so that, you know, it's not something that every doctor or nurse or staff member has dealt with before or deals with on a regular basis. So their ability to manage that situation kind of in a compassionate, efficient, and sensitive way may not be perfect. And I think certainly there are some personalities that just don't even know how to handle that situation because it's just so emotionally charged. But
right.
I think that being said, I think there's absolutely more room to improve training of staff dealing with stillbirth. And so I think that when you have events like this that are rare, it's really important to provide repetitive in-services for staff members, and whether that be lectures or mock drills or role-playing, anything to just kind of remind them over and over again of kind of what needs to happen, because you can't just like put a binder behind a desk and expect them to be compassionate.
Right.
So,
and I agree. Mm-hmm. I agree that there should be, like, it sounds terrible, but kind of like hands-on training where people have, like, an experience where they discuss
mm-hmm.
and see how they would be able to handle it if it happened
mm-hmm.
on their shift
mm-hmm.
or something
mm-hmm.
of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
So,
no,
I mean,
I think with medical care, they're really moving towards that. The medical students that go through their training, they have to talk to actors in terms of delivering bad news and
right.
dealing with a difficult situation. And they get graded on how they do that, and they get immediate feedback with that. And so I think that at least from the physician side, hopefully with the next generation of physicians, we're going to be a little bit better. But I do think that that takes effort on departments that you're dealing with, the staff that you have now. And so I know even at USC, we brought in an expert. Her name is Kylie Haneesh, and she has this Return to Zero Center for Healing. She came and talked to our department about this very issue because I really wanted her to sit down with the residents and really talk to them about what it was like. She personally suffered a loss, and to really explore with them kind of how she felt and what she really needed from the people that were taking care of her at that time.
Yes, I'm actually familiar with the movie. I saw it on
yeah.
Lifetime, so it brought a lot of feelings and memories
mm-hmm.
back. So, I mean,
mm-hmm.
I think with hope that there will be more training and compassion. And like you said, it's something that's very hard to deal with on a professional level, a personal level,
mm-hmm.
on every level. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, guys. Thank you so much. I think we need to wind up the discussion now because we have reached the end of the hour. Dr. Bendixson, thank you so much for being here with us today. And it was a wonderful discussion. And we wish you all the best with your new Center for Pregnancy Loss. I'm sure it's going to be a help to the patients as well as to the caregivers as well. And Fran, thank you so much for co-hosting with me. And Davina,
thank you
and congratulations for all you do with the infertility community. And I must mention that you're doing a commendable job with your Banking on the Future program.
Thank you.
I hope this discussion would serve as a good reference for many who are searching for authentic information on the recurrent miscarriages. And audience, I thank you for your support, and we look forward to having you all join us on our next Cure Talk show on 31st March 2015 at 5 p.m. Eastern Time to discuss emerging immunotherapies in myeloma treatment with Dr. Saad Usmani. For more information on this show and other upcoming shows, please visit our website, www.curetalks.com, or you can email at priya@trialx.com. The link for today's show will be sent in via email to all the participants. So until the next show, thank you very much, everyone.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.